Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Crime. LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and Mr. David Martino is in the room.
I'm here.
Sly after the long weekend. Yes. Did you do karate over any of that stuff? Did you have a karate day, you know?
No, not until Tuesday.
Oh, so you've been lazy.
Lazy. Just, you know, taking it easy.
Laying around.
Laying around.
And watching movies. Not even making the wife dinner. You have to go out and buy it.
That's right. I had to drive. I had to drive down. I had to pick up the food. I had to drive back. It's tiring.
I'll put it on a plate. Put the dishes in the dishwasher. Boy. Struggling.
Yeah.
Struggling life. You know?
It's terrible.
Well, speaking of struggles in life, okay, we have a writer, and he's got a book out, and based on a lot of his life, so we'll go find out all about this. So it's All in a Day's Work, An Officer's Account, 20 years NYPD, John Fariso. How are you doing?
Doing great tonight.
So listen, John, the first thing I have to say is, what made you want to write a book about what you were doing in your life as work, which was a cop?
When I was in college, I was working a lot of side jobs. I was waiting on tables and things of that nature. And I knew I was going to be a police officer because I was waiting to get called. And I used to say, like, wow, these jobs are so boring, nothing to write about. And I said, wow, I'm pretty soon going to be on a job that I know I can write about. So I made that decision before I was even a sworn officer that I was going to write about the job. And I was very intrigued in college about cops who wrote. I thought they had a lot of integrity to come out after they retired and write their stories. I found them very fascinating, interesting. So I decided I was going to write. And then very early on in my career, I said I would slowly write things down that I noticed and the quirks and coworkers and stuff like that. So in the academy, I was taking notes outside of my classwork and was putting them in a spiral notebook because, you know, this was 1993 at the time. So they were in a spiral notebook. And I would go home and sometimes I would fine tune it. And then I would, towards the end of the week, I would kind of condense things together. And nothing was like really that writable at that time that would really make it into my books later. I do mention the police academy, but that's really where it began. And then as soon as I got to the precinct, it's as a police officer anywhere in this country, you know, you get on the job training very fast. It's very hard to teach you something in the police academy that you're going to be expecting on the street. It's going to happen. It happens fast. And within the first week, I was involved in a few incidents that I was like, wow. All right. So I became an extension of the actual cop stories I had written. I had, you know, read as in college. And I was like, wow, I could write my own stories. So my little note, pen to paper, how it had some substance to it. And I was writing about actual crimes and actual criminals we caught. And a lot of times I wrote about the things I witnessed that the person wasn't caught. So, and that would continue on throughout my career, that writing, as I went into different units and got into more prestigious units and got promoted, I kept writing.
Well, what was in your mind, like at the beginning back in the 90s, when you thought about right from the get-go, you want to write about your experience as a cop? What was in your mind that you were hoping that you were going to be able to tell people? Like, what were you thinking that this would be about?
Well, I knew my stories would be interesting because I was working for the NYPD. You know, we had 30,000 police officers, the largest police department in the country. And, you know, movies and TV shows are made about the NYPD. And I had watched those movies and TV shows growing up. And as soon as I got to the precinct, I started to realize that a lot of them were not correct. And I was going to start to, I didn't want to, you know, write about the mundane, but I wanted to write about the fun stuff. I put a lot of cop humor in it. Cop humor is, Hollywood has it correct. There's a lot of cop humor going on, and it's never done in front of the witness. It's never done in front of the family, but it's done on the side in the police cars and in the detective bureau. You know, cop humor can be dry, but it makes for an interesting story, and it kind of, a lot of the cop humor made it into a lot of my stories.
Yeah, it's you know, in a way, a lot of my experience with different cops are, I even have the same sense of humor in a way. It's kind of a relief and a release of the stress, I would imagine, too, right? And it's kind of a gallows humor.
Yes, you're correct. I believe you said gallows humor. It is called that also. And it's a release of the stress, and it definitely allows you to, I'm not saying distance yourself from it, but to let everybody and yourself know that you're not internalizing this. And a lot of the cop humor is only made around other offices. It does make it at home at times, but, you know, my wife didn't understand it. My sisters didn't understand it. You know, some of my friends did, but even after a while, they were like, I don't get it. It's like, then it's just cop humor. And sometimes people would ask me questions and, you know, I would tell them about something, but I always made it through the cop humor into it. So it's there.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's just the way of dealing with it, the way you tell it, and it's going to be. What's the premise behind this book? So what stories have you chosen and why did you choose them, do you think?
Originally, I wanted to write about my whole entire career from the academy till the day I retired, which was 20 years. And short stories were always my favorite, short cop stories written by officers from all over the country. And I liked how the stories were all mixed together. And, you know, one day the officer in Tennessee did this, and one day the officer in the big city did this. And I thought those stories were great. And being that I had worked in so many different units, I didn't condense it, but I just took pieces of everything that was interesting to me and I thought would interesting to the reader. And sometimes something happens so quickly at work, it couldn't make it to a story. So my short stories are all from one page to 13 pages. So they're mainly funny things that happened on patrol, interesting people I dealt with, investigations I dealt with. And I stayed away from a lot of, I caught the bad guy, we chased them, we fell over two garbage pails. I really kept those stories out because those stories have been done so many times. I felt that I could write it differently. And I kept police gore out of it. I kept all that out. You know, I left a lot of the darkness out of it that a reader would find upsetting. I mean, they could read between the lines and see what I'm talking about when I get to a crime scene. But I didn't really describe the gore and things like that. If it was something I wasn't willing to talk about with my friends, then I didn't think it should go in the book. So I wrote about stuff that I felt people would be interested in.
Right. And so that's you must have had a lot of stories through the years. You must have dealt with so much, such a variety of things. What was at the core of why you choose certain things to talk about? Was it more about how it affected you, or is there a point to it? Do you think there's something like when you tell a story that you kind of think it's a lesson that maybe people could pick up on? Like, kind of what made you select the stories you did?
A lot of the stories I selected were ones that other people found interesting when I told them. So, like, if I had a story, I wrote a story about a woman who was fighting with her boyfriend, and she ended up stabbing him in the stomach, and he was walking towards us in the hallway. And we thought he was the actual perpetrator when it turns out it was her. And we went in the apartment, and she was nonchalantly on the phone with her friends like nothing happened. And he was like, it was nothing happened. And we were like trying to figure out, is this what really happened? And then she wanted him arrested, but he couldn't be arrested. She said he pulled a hair. And while we're putting the handcuffs on her, he's telling us he loves her. And, you know, the EMS is trying to save his life, and he's screaming that he loves her. So I would tell my friends that story, and they couldn't believe it. And I said, you know, I could put that on paper. Like, that story could make it to paper. I think people would be interesting to read it. The name of that story in my short stories is called Ma'am, Put Down the Phone.
People can really be strange. and I would imagine that would be the hardest thing to deal with as a cop, is kind of you don't know how the people you're going to see are going to react, or what they're going to think is normal behavior.
Correct. And I even wrote in that book that right before that I was drinking my coffee, and we will thought it was going to be a quiet night. It wasn't. And then right after that incident, we went out and got coffee, and, you know, three cops sitting around drinking coffee like it never happened.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that in the book too.
Yeah. And that must be kind of the weird thing that people don't understand, you know, when they look or see or hear about cops, is how you can be just go out for coffee like nothing happened, you know?
Police work is a type of profession, and I mean, there's a few others, I'm sure, emergency room nurse, certain surgeons, doctors, that you can't internalize it. If you internalize it, you're not going to make it through your career. And it will be either a very, very difficult career, or you're going to quit before it, because it's not for everybody. You can't internalize it, because you can't save the world, but you can help a lot of people. And along the way, you have to be exposed to things that normal people should never see in their lifetime. And I wrote in the very early part of my book that a New York City police officer will see more in the first week or within the first month what most people will not see in a lifetime. And that's a big reason why I wrote, because if I'm seeing all these things and there's an audience out there interested in what police work really is, then I'm going to put it down on paper and they can see it.
Well, what's it like going, you know, being in a profession like this where you're going from zero to 60, where nothing's happening, then all hell breaks loose, and then you've got to kind of come down from that and go back to zero again. You know, how do you do that?
You have to learn that fast, because I think it was the first week I was in the precinct, they put me on a foot post on a very busy street. And people there are very nice, and everybody goes about doing their business. And I witnessed a fight in front of me, so I saw it, and I walked over, and I told the guys to leave. And then, you know, I was a very new rookie. And, you know, one of the guys leaves, and the other guy rips his shirt open, curses me out, and is telling me to shoot him in front of everybody. So I'm standing there like, wow, this is serious. This is okay. So I took out my nightstick. I was like, okay, if you get any closer, you're going to get hit. You know, and some backup arrived, and then the guy took off running. And then the other officers are like, what happened? I told them. They're like, it's just a fight. He's gone. I'm like, yeah, he's gone. The other guy left. And then, you know, everybody goes on their way. And now I'm back on the foot post again. And, you know, people are walking up to me saying, Officer Fariso, this is 82nd Street. How do you get to 31st Avenue? And I'm giving them directions 5 minutes later. That's how fast it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no police report for that. Absolutely none. There was no police report for that incident.
Mm-hmm.
It never happened.
Wow. Okay, so when you're doing this and that, we were talking a little bit earlier, but so the other cops around you and other people, your partners or people you worked with and stuff like that, none of them were really aware that you were kind of had the intention of writing a book.
No, they didn't. They didn't have the intention. I mean, they didn't know what I was doing, that I had the intention of writing, because it goes back to cop humor. If I had told them I was writing, that every joke every day would have been about me writing a book. So every time I did something, they'd be like, hey, stay away, Fariso's writing a book. Or every time somebody lost something, oh, I'm going to let Fariso find it. He's the one writing the book. He's got all the time. So, you know, I figured, why put that added, even though it would have been a joke, why put that added attention to me? So I kept it quiet that I was writing a book.
Now, you weren't really focusing on any of the people you were working with so much as you were on your own kind of experience, right?
Oh, yes, totally. I mean, I joke around with my family. I go, I wrote 61 stories. Each story, it revolves around me and what I do. So I didn't focus on anybody else. And believe me, I could have. You want to talk about fiction, man, I could have wrote one heck books out of the characters I worked with. I work with all types of people. And I could have done that, but I didn't see that was what I wanted to do. I didn't, there's other people that write like that. That's not for me.
Yeah. Were you careful about how you wrote any violence or anything like that in there, any murder?
Correct. I did, because I had done later in my career, I was a sergeant in both the Internal Affairs Bureau and in the Detective Bureau, which was the missing person squad. So I had some high profile cases in both of those. And there was other times I didn't have the high profile case, but we had cases when there was no real conclusion to what happened. So when I wrote about it, you know, I had to kind of like leave it open-ended, but it was left open-ended because there really wasn't an answer. So like if somebody writes a cozy mystery, there's always an answer. We caught the bad guy. We did this, you know, everything's perfect and, you know, life went on. But a lot of times, you know, there was a victim, there was a crime. We had a suspect and witnesses, and it can become a very convoluted story, because you really never find out exactly what's going on, because not everybody's truthful to you. So I wrote it the way I saw it, and I wrote it from what I've seen directly. I stayed away a lot from what my coworkers were thinking or doing, because it was hard for me at times to figure out why they would take a case in a separate angle than I was looking at. They had a different perspective on something. And if I felt I was correct, a few times I felt I was correct and they weren't, but it was their case and they had to take it in the angle they did. But I didn't write about the mistakes they made. I kind of left that out.
Well, how did you write on the job? How did you, you know, write these stories on the job? Were you writing in a patrol vehicle, in an office? Did you use a notebook? Did you use the patrol vehicle's laptop? How did that work for you?
No, definitely didn't use the patrol vehicle's laptop. That would have been interesting. I would have been called down. Hey, Fariso, you're writing about your coworkers. You want to tell us something? No, it was a spiral notebook. And I guess if any of my coworkers saw me with a spiral notebook, they didn't know what it was. So that spiral notebook stayed with me for a while, and I kept replacing it. I guess, you know, it was easy. You buy a spiral notebook for $1.99. And it was old school pencil to paper. And I would sometimes I took actual notes, like on index cards. Like if I was on a We called them fixture posts. When you were on a corner or in a small vehicle, you would be on a fixture post. And then I would bring these little cue cards in my jacket, and I would take notes on that and then transcribe them into the spiral notebook. But a lot of times in the detective bureau, something would happen, and I got a really good memory, but I still like to put pencil to paper quick. So even though it was locked in my mind, I put pencil to paper quick because I don't want to lose the moment. And then when I would go home, I'd write it more. But then around 2000, my first computer, you know, Microsoft Word was really propelled me because, man, I could put it down and save it. I don't have to worry about losing anything.
Yeah, amazing what the computer did to the world.
Made a writer out of me.
Yeah. So listen, today's climate of behavior with people with the computer involved, being online and all that, the access people have and stuff, what do you think people get wrong most in general about police, New York police, let's just say?
There's a lot they get wrong. It's not, I can't just say the NYPD, but I could say about right. every police department. Well, I never worked in other police departments, but police work has a lot of commonalities. Okay, the NYPD, we're never as busy as they portray us, which may sound strange, even though I said before how busy we are, but nobody is that busy. Like, I was a big fan of Hill Street Blues growing up, even though that was not an NYPD story. It showed that I don't think you could do that every day and deal with that every day. But when you watched NYPD Blue, there was always a major crime happening, and there was always the socialite in the townhouse and the missing Wall Street executive's kid. That's not really the case. You know, when crimes happen, it's usually, unfortunately, lower rungs of society amongst each other. And it's not always the high profile people. You don't really deal with that. You actually deal with a lot of people who have been dealing with the police for a long time. So, you know, when these movies and TV and writing and stuff and screenplays, if they want it to be correct, you have to constantly run into people who know the system pretty well, which would be your suspect has been arrested numerous times. One of my first arrests for shoplifting, the guy told me, I just got out of prison. I did many years. He goes, come on, let's go to the precinct. No big deal. He goes, this is a joke to me. I'll spend the night in jail. And that's how it works.
Yeah, it's too bad. So how did you pick your stories? Like, what is the most memorable story that you've put in this?
I have a few memorable stories. They go in the different groups where I worked. But I have one it's the very first story in the book. It's called Even a Little Incident Can Go a Long Way. It was when I was in the missing person squad, and it was just a quiet night, and a woman called. Well, actually, no, not a woman. It was a younger woman. You'll see in the book there is an age issue in it. And she claimed she had amnesia, didn't know who she was, and she was lost in Manhattan. And the story went viral with social media that night. And I was the lead investigator on that case. And as we investigated it, we were getting a lot of tips, and we were sending detectives everywhere. And we had online sleuths calling us, and major media outlets, I will say, picked up the story, and they were putting her picture on, and we were getting calls from all over the country. And unfortunately, as the night was going on, I started to get phone calls from women in California asking me if that's their daughter. And I had to do some online research. I didn't understand what they were talking about. And it turns out she looked a lot like two women that went missing. California, and I was dealing with the mothers of which I found out later were victims. These girls were victims of a serial killer. And so they were calling me trying to piece it together if this is their kid. And while this is all going on, we were investigating her story within Manhattan. And it was a couple of hours, and the story went viral, and it went cross country for a short period of time.
What kind of pressure does that put you on when nowadays that we have the computer and a story goes viral? And everyone's talking about it. What does that change the way you investigate?
Yes, it does. Because as soon as the detective told me that it was going on the nightly news, I told all my detectives, we're going to start, the phones are going to light up. We used to have a saying, phones are going to light up. Phones did start lighting up. And then the next call was, it was going on a major news outlet that goes across the country. And I told every detective in the office, I said, get ready. This is an all-nighter. Every drunk, amateur sleuth and wacko from across America is going to start calling. And the call started right away. And we had to take these calls and listen to these people. And almost every call had no merit to it. I did speak to two truck drivers who described the girl pretty well. And they talked about two different truck drivers in two different states described the girl they picked up and drove cross country. when a truck driver calls and, you know, late at night, you kind of can listen to him and say, well, this guy might know what he's talking about, because, you know, these guys, they observe things. And those are the only two calls I got that were part of the story. The rest of them were just concerned family members. And you had a feel for these mothers that they were calling. And I had to give them answers the best I could. Eventually, they did say that wasn't their daughter when I showed her the picture, but it was a long night on that case.
It's going to be hard dealing with all of that, especially with the internet now, because so many people giving tips, as they say, or calling in or wanting to be part of the investigation, or people trying to solve the crime. I think that would be the most frustrating, because if you're a cop working the detail, you're there, you know the people involved, you're at the setting, the scene, you get to see everything personally. It's a lot different than someone on the internet looking at something 3,000 miles away saying, oh, they did this wrong, or they should do this. That's got to be real frustrating.
It is. And that was the beginning of the online sleuths. And, you know, the online sleuths, some of them are good, but, you know, 90% of them are just, you know, they shouldn't be doing what they're doing. But some of them are good. And I could tell when I find one that is, and I'll speak to them on the side. Oh, yeah. And we would, you know, there was times that I had cases when I would interview people. I had a case like this in Internal Affairs when I was interviewing someone, and I really felt that he was just trying to put himself into the story, and he had nothing to add. He just wanted to be part of it. And as I talked to him, I started to catch on that this guy's not adding nothing. He's just happened to be in the area, and now he's part of the case, and he wants to be this witness, and he saw this, and he really, as talking to him, he didn't see anything. He just, for whatever reason, I don't know if he watched too many cop movies growing up, but man, it was, I had to put some work into this guy, and there was no reason for it.
Yeah, that's going to be tough. So Internal Affairs, does that separate you from most of the cops in a way when you work something like that? Doesn't that kind of put you in a different division in the fact that you're watching them?
Oh, yes, correct. It does. I went as a supervisor. I wasn't a detective. I went as a sergeant. So the NYPD drafted me there and then was like, we'll give us 2 years and you can go wherever you want. So while I was there, I knew it was only a stepping stone in my career. So when I left the precinct, you know, I got the hard stares. Nobody was outright rude to me, but I wasn't really looking for that. So I got the hard stares. A few people didn't say goodbye. A few people came up to me on the side and were like, you know, John, I'll talk to you again soon. You know, you're going to do your time there, whatever. So it is a difficult move, but I looked at it like my friends were my friends. The real cops were the real cops. And any cop who really knows how to do his job and really knew police work and was a good officer would know that you can't just write off someone because they spent time in Internal Affairs. But you're correct. It is very separate. And it's something that most cops will avoid. It's something I did. And I thought about not writing about it because I felt like just leaving that part of my career out. But I had so many stories. How could I leave out that wealth of knowledge? So a few of those stories made it in.
Yeah. I guess you have to be kind of careful on what you talk about in certain stories like that, right?
Oh, correct. Yes. I have one where I worked pretty big investigation that was pretty viral here in New York City. And I had to leave out a lot of details, names, places, and I didn't put any speculation into that because there was families involved, there was officers involved, and there was victims. So I kept that out, yeah.
Well, during your tenure as a police officer, were there a lot of changes in police work?
Yes. In the beginning, computers came in big. The computers in the car were very basic. They were block-like with, you know, it looked like you were playing a Pong game from the 70s on it. So we called them the mobile digital computers. They got better as we were there. And then the reports became digitized. And then later when I was in the detective bureau, it was less and less paper. You very rarely heard a typewriter, less and less paper, and everything went online. And, this was in, when I was in the detective bureau, this was around 2008. So, you know, emails were starting, so there was less communication. And I saw the early signs because I had a lot of young detectives with me. I saw the early signs of cops trying to do their investigations entirely through the computer. And I was starting to see the less and less old school about guys getting out, knocking on doors. So I noticed it coming. So anyone that's on the job now, I say on the job, that's the term we use with that, but anyone's on the job now will probably tell you that they've seen there was a lot of people trying to do their actual work from behind a computer. But there are times you have to get out there, knock on a door, and speak.
So, of course, the big day, 9/11. And so you've mentioned that for the book. So what can you tell us about that? You know, what was it like being a cop then?
Well, it was a very clear day, and it was a perfect day. And, you know, I ate breakfast that morning thinking I had to go get suited for a suit that night. So that was my main concern. And, you know, I didn't know within 2 hours my whole day would be turned upside down and everything would be turned upside down. So I was working at that time a temporary assignment because I was ready to get promoted. So they put me to One Police Plaza, which is a half mile from the house. And, you know, I was at the office window when I heard the explosion, which was the first plane hit. And it shook my building, and explosion was loud enough for everybody to jump out of their seat.
How do you think this whole event changed you as a person or a cop?
Well, you know, it made me realize that, you know, you could wake up in the morning and your day will not be what you expect. So I when I was a kid, I used to talk to a lot of veterans, and they would say, you know, kid, I think about this every day of my life. And I said, there's no way you are remembering one incident and you are thinking about it every day of your life. And I think about 9/11 every single day, not in a bad way. It's it could be simple as a construction crew in the street, construction on a building, a large crowd coming out of the subway. It could be a large sound, a low-flying plane. I think about 9/11 every single day, but ironically, I was writing even then, and I had my spiral notebook with me in my backpack that day. So when I ran from my building, that spiral notebook with my notes was in my backpack, and it stayed with me throughout that whole day. And not that night, but within that first week, I started writing because there was no way, even though it was locked in my mind forever, I had to put that pen to paper. If I witnessed 9/11, there was no way I wasn't going to tell everybody who was interested to hear about it.
So what are you hoping that people would get out of this book when they take it home and read it?
Well, back to the 9/11, I left that the date of 9/11 out. The reason I did that is because I decided it's 17 pages. It's a short story. If anybody wants it, you could find it online, find it on my website. You could put it in the show notes. Now, I decided to put that out for free. The reason I did that is I never wanted to make any money off that. It's just my story, how I saw it. I feel that I could educate people who either don't remember it, weren't born, or didn't see it the way other people see it. I could explain everything I saw, how I saw it. So if anybody wants to see that, that's all there. I left that totally out of my book, but it's free online. I did write about the days after 9/11. And the reason I did that is because I saw the human side of New York City. I saw the human side of after the tragedy. So I decided to write about those little days. So I think when people see my book, first they're going to see that police officers, detectives, whatever, were not always portrayed correctly in the movies. I know the movies need to glamorize things, but, you know, they glamorize the divorced cop who's an alcoholic. He's fighting with everybody around him. He's a lone wolf. You know, that's not really common. If anybody had one of those people as a worker with them, that person would stand out because they would be considered a hazard. So I want people to take out of it that, you know, police work is interesting. It's dangerous. It's in your face. It happens very quickly, and it's not what everybody expected. And there's a reason why only a few people in our society can do that job. So I also talk about the investigations I did and the process behind it, because Hollywood and, you know, books, they have them catching these people right away. And that's actually rare to catch someone right away. It's, you know, it takes some time, and you have to really research them and find them. And sometimes you find them in very interesting ways that you didn't expect it. So when people read my book, they'll take those things out of it.
So what's your favorite cop TV?
I mentioned earlier it was Hill Street Blues. That was by far the best TV show ever made. When I watched that, I was in junior high school when that movie TV show was around, and I knew that a cop had written that script, because I don't think anybody could have made that story up without knowledge. In regards to movies, I would say Fort Apache, The Bronx, and Serpico were the two of the best movies, police movies ever made.
I thought you were going to say Barney Miller. No,
Barney Miller. That was very good. It was they had the dry cop humor in Barney Miller. It was the detective office squad room dry humor, which is very – that humor was correct. So whoever wrote that, I believe, had seen the jokes and been there for it.
So where do you see yourself going now? So what do you plan on doing now with your life? Continue writing?
I'm currently writing a second book in regards to missing persons investigations, because that was my expertise when I left. That's really where I stood out and did the best work. So how a screenwriter or an author could properly put a missing persons investigation into their story. I talk about everything from the 911 caller to the cold case and everything in between, the cop humor, the officers in the precinct, the officers in the detective bureau, the types of family members that would call. I even talk about the psychics that would call and we would, you know, listen to them and never put them in the report. So I got all these little details in there because I noticed that missing persons investigations are quite often written about. And there's another one that's wrong a lot, but I show how you can put the correct investigation in and still make it interesting.
So you get any good calls from psychics? Anybody solve the crime for you?
Oh, they know exactly where the body is, exactly where it's buried. And if you took a shovel and a sledgehammer and were there, you'd find the dead body in 10 minutes. They used to call at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, well, the regulars, you know, that's good.
They were interesting to talk to, but it never made it to the report.
Yeah. So what's your relationship like now with police or anybody that you worked with before now that you're writing? Does it make any difference?
A lot of them think it's great. You know, what's funny is now that I'm retired, you know how many of them tell me they wish they did or they should or they give me little things. Do you ever think about writing about this? Do you ever think around about that? Very few people are like, and if they are, they're not telling me. It's possible that people are like, I can't believe he wrote about this. But that's another misconception. Cops aren't like, it's us versus them. You can't talk about this. You can't talk about that. There's things you can't talk about. And writers aren't going to put that in the book because it's not interesting. It shouldn't be in the book. It's not fair. So most guys are very supportive. And when I was younger, I looked up to those officers who wrote. I thought that was great that you could be in that career and write about it, be a writer and a detective. I thought that was great. So I hope people see that in me. Like, wow, he did all this police work and he's writing about it. He's talking about it. I find it great that people are interested in stuff I did 30 years ago.
How do you think it's changed over the 30 years? You know, are cops different now than they were 30 years ago?
Yes, I have family who are on the job now and they're in the NYPD. It's changed a lot. There's a new generation there. They're very in tune to the world more than we were. Computer orientated, maybe not as closed-minded at times, because we could be, an old generation could be more closed-minded on issues, which you have to learn at times. I think that they've learned that pretty quick. I think there will be more writers because the younger generation is quicker to talk, where I would say the generation before me said, hey, you just do your thing and that's it, never happens, just move on. So I think the new officers are better, but unfortunately, I think that the politics is keeping them from doing the actual police work they should be doing.
Yeah, still a problem, eh? So when you wrote this book, and now that you're finished it and you look back, do you think the process of writing these stories out and putting it out for people, does that change you?
Not yet, because I'm still a new author. It does give me a sense of pride that people are interested. Like when I get a sale in London or Japan, I think it's great. And, you know, hey, somebody in London's reading my book. That's pretty wild, you know. I guess as I write more and as I get older and I get more feedback, yes. But it's awesome when someone reads my story and is, especially when they don't believe it was true. Somebody believed, did that really happen? I go, no, that happens. The truth is stranger than fiction. That's why it's in there. So that I guess would change me in a better way, where I would, more self-confidence to write the next book.
Well, and just look at the world. God, you look at real life, it's crazy. So I, you know, nowadays, after the last 10 years, I believe almost anything you wrote.
like the day before 9/11, if you would have told me that would have happened, I would have said, yes, and elephants are going to run through the streets alone in that. Like, yeah, okay, that's never going to. So, and it did. So I don't think anything would surprise me.
Yeah. Yeah. You start to realize as you get older that it's just, there's things happen, you know, it goes that way. So where do you draw your inspiration from?
My inspiration was from mostly my coworkers that gave me the stories to write about. My inspiration was from the writers. I read their books, the unknown writers that I read about years ago, and some of the movies and TV shows I watched. There was other movies and TV shows that maybe didn't have police work in the whole movie, but I think I believe it was Dog Day Afternoon had some unbelievable scenes in it that really resonated, where, you know, that's police work and that's how it's done.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite a job. Well, that's interesting. So now, are you set up with social media and website and all that? Do you want people to interact with you after they read your book, or even if they haven't read it?
Yes, correct. Feedback is great. You know, I'm one of these people. Feedback, positive and negative, is great. You know, I can tell stories about negative feedback I got in other areas of my life that really propelled me to fix things. And, you know, hey, feedback is awesome. It only helps me for my second endeavor into writing. So my website is ferrisinvestigations.org. I am a private eye in New York City, so I do private eye work. So my private eye stuff is on there, and also my writing, that's on there. And I'm on all the other social media outlets out there.
Okay, well, we'll make sure that's up on our website along with your book and stuff. So what's it like being a private eye now?
It's that's another one where Hollywood has it wrong. So it private eye work is kind of gritty. It's very ironically, it's a type of work you avoided as a police officer, which I find interesting. So it's you know, when I took the private eye license, it's a lot, because what happened was I was networking with a lot of detectives, and they kept asking me missing person questions. And I was like, well, I'm retired. And they were like, yeah, but John, you did it. What do we should do with this? I was like, all right, let me open up this private eye business. So I said to myself, I wasn't going to do the cheating spouses cases. I was going to stay away from the dirty work, which would be cheating spouses, crappy hotels at 2 a.m. You know, I didn't retire to do that. There are other private eyes that do that type of work, and some make a lot of money doing it, but it's just not for me at this point in my life. So being a private eye is interesting. I could probably write stories about that. I do a lot of nonprofit work, ironically, because I get a lot of calls from detectives or investigators throughout the country about missing person cases. And they'll ask me that they have a case and where they are with it. And at times I will look at their entire case and I'll give them some advice on what to do. A lot of times there's a lot of steps missed years ago, especially on cold cases. Stuff was missed years ago on accident and the families didn't get an answer. And I've worked on cases for nonprofits that work is being done now that was missed years ago. And it's a cold case, but they're still working on it.
Yeah, I imagine it would be interesting. And you get all sorts of calls asking you to do all sorts of things, you know?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And anybody call you to go out and look for Bigfoot or anything like that?
I haven't gotten Bigfoot. I had a woman who was not exactly sure her story, but I think her family, her kids were removed away from her from the courts. So she was wanting me to find them because they were missing. So I did a little background research on this woman and found out that I don't know if it was mental issues or just a very bad situation. So I think that I'm pretty good at fielding people when they call. I know when I speak to them, and if I hear a little conspiracy theory in them, or lying is very common, which is I had one just recently when the husband would not let me speak to the wife, and they wanted their daughter was missing. And I found out it was not even the husband, it was the stepfather. So I figured if I'm going to take this case, I have to really speak to this woman on the side. And the husband started telling me his wife didn't speak English, and she spoke perfect English. So it was just too much drama going on there. And the police department already had the case, so I told them basically everything they need to present to the police that I was going to do. But there was way too much drama with that, and they weren't being truthful. So that's common in private eye work. It's I don't know if people are watching TV and they think they could just do these things to us, but you know, we're retired. We can pick and choose where we work.
This is a very interesting career and life and book you've got out, and appreciate you coming on the show.
Great.
The book is called All in a Day's Work, and it's an officer's account, 20 years, NYPD. John Ferriso, thank you for being here.
Great, guys. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, John.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.